So, the topic that in a way, in a light way, fits the fact that this is a retreat that is between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, means between the creation, the celebration of the creation of the world, and Yom Kippur, which is the question, what do we do now that we're created in the world? What do we do with this world? So between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, this is this retreat. So paying a little attention to that fact. So the title of the talk is, how do we shift our fate? And how do we change our experience? And a very simple question, but a very difficult one. Can we shift our fate? Goral Shelanu. And Lila took from the Sidur kind of a key, the Machzor, sorry, of Yom Kippur, a key phrase, Tshuva Tfila Tzedakah Ma'avirin Roa Hagzera. Like, and she addressed the issue of Tshuva. And I want to address the second bit, which is the heavy bit. Ma'avirin, how do we stop this fate from giving us its makot? And incidentally, it occurs to me that the three words, tshuva, tefillah, tzedakah, match exactly the key summary of the whole Buddhist path, which is sila, samadhi, panya. Sila being tzedakah, samadhi being tefillah, and panya being tshuva. And it's so amazing just how it really kind of clicks together. I mean, the fact is, we all want a better life. We all want to live more happily and joyfully. We all want a better future. We don't want a dark future. We want a light future. If we are believers, we will believe in Olam Haba or a reincarnation. Next life, we want it better. We're tending as human beings to be born and to ask about the future, what will be, and worry about it, and hope for it, and pray for it, and be busy with it. And Yom Kippur itself, of course, is full of that. To some extent, all of that occupation with Atid, the future, is based on fear. It's based on our insecurity, which is, let's not be too critical, it's the insecurity of all lived beings, of every ant, of every creature that's born. It's a fundamental existential insecurity, and it makes every creature insecure and busy with survival, and therefore full of issues about what will be to me tomorrow, next year, next life, whatever. But even if, even in the most traditional places, and here this phrase, Ma'avirin Roa Hagzera, indicates something dynamic. Because if you can stop it, Ma'avirin, if Tshuva, Tefillah, and Tzedakah can actually stop it, these things are said to stop it or change it, it means it's something is dynamic in all of this. That it's not just a big sword hanging over us, fixed fate, that our fate is written there in the book and nothing we can do about it. There are movements traditionally which are very strong in that direction. And here there's a sort of, in the Jewish world and also in the Tibetan world, there's often a very strong belief system in something very fixed, written down. Our future is written down. Karma is a kind of engraved, and it's traditional. But I think we can look again at karma, and I want to take a few minutes really to explore karma with you before we go back to the question, which is how we change our experience. Let's have a look at karma for a minute, because it is such a fundamental wisdom, not only of course of Buddhist teaching, but also of the whole of the Eastern world from the Vedic times onwards. So what is karma? So I'll give you an example. Just go back over the last minute or 2 minutes and ask yourself what were your thoughts, and you will be thinking, what's he going to say? I want to know. I want to know the secret. I expect something interesting. If you think about what you just thought in that space, when I ask the question, what is karma, or what, I'm going to say something about karma, you will realize you have been processing something which happened. It's just a word that I offered. I'm going to give an example of karma. And you, after that, process it in a somewhat automatic way. In other words, the past, namely my statement, I'm going to give an example of karma, created and put pressure on the present. And you had thoughts based on the past, like expectations that I will give something. So the pressure of the past on the present that forms it and shapes it. You know, imagine that there was no karma of the pressure of the past. In that minute of silence after I said, I will give an example of karma, there would be absolute total freedom in this room, with no expectations, no thoughts especially, total spontaneity and absolute utter freedom and endless being. And we were not like that. We were formed, we expected things, we had a dialogue in the mind, right? So karma is simply pressure of habits and patterns and forms that keep going from the past to the present all the time. And we are kind of created. These are tracks. Masluleen, these are tracks. Based on actions and reactions. Every time we act in a certain way, we are creating karma for the next moment. How we act creates the type of karma of the next moment. The reactions that we have create the sort of same kind of next moment. So the seeds we sow are similar to the fruits that are that are ripened from these seeds that we sow. So it's kind of the tracks are karma. And karma is equivalent to creation, Briya. Okay, in the Eastern view, you can almost replace them. The word Briya in the Jewish tradition or Judeo-Christian tradition can be replaced by karma. It's the kind of self-creating world that is created on the basis of the blueprint or the pattern of what was creates the next thing. It rolls. And we are made from it. So we are constantly making ourselves. We're not a thing, a Stephen that suddenly appeared and is forever just a Stephen. Stephen is Stephening himself. Leela is Leelaing herself. We are constantly recreating ourselves based on the blueprint that was of this moment. And sometimes you might have woken up in the morning and not known who you really are. And that moment is often a moment of great freedom and joy. And then the boring old person comes back that you know, and everything is kind of returned to the old thing that you know you're a Stephen. Oh, here I am again. I thought I got out of that, but here I am again. And it is difficult. It is the difficulty of our life, karma, in a way, because it's like goes round and we feel trapped. And this is the nature of samsara, is a wheel. Samsara is the wheel. Samsara is the creation again and again and again of the present based on the past. So we feel ourselves trapped a little bit in this wheel, like there is a sort of image from the from Jewish tradition of the human being is a bit like insects in a jar, in a tzinsenet, that we climb up and we fall down and we climb up and we fall down. It's a sort of a horrible image, but there is something like Rumi once asked, what do we do with this life that doesn't go away? There's something unstoppable about karma. It just creates things, and here we are on the wheel going round and round, and it's quite difficult to get us off. And that's what we feel is painful for us. There is dukkha, there is pain of the being, feeling somewhat trapped in this life, and our freedom of awareness, freedom of playfulness, freedom or ultimate freedom is restricted by karma. Karma, it does it through, I won't go into the whole Buddhist teaching, it's huge teaching and you can learn it other times in other courses, but it's through sankharas. Sankharas are kind of engravings or formations or constructions, and that's kind of part of the teaching. How it happens is really well worked out, and so on and so on. Won't go into it now. But sankharas are formations, constructions, which is exactly like that little experiment I did with you before, where I offered a sentence and you built from there your own reactions, like the pattern that says what's going to be said now, or expectation is a sankhara, is a construction in the mind. It can also be in the body. DNA is a wonderful sankhara. So the Buddha created a beautiful teaching in which expressing very, very well the Buddhist way, which is called the middle way. And it's the middle way between extremes that seem to be the truth, but are only a relative truth because of our experience. And in terms of fate, he said, the world is not a frozen, deterministic world, because that offers no freedom and no possibility for freedom, and no possibility for liberation or change. And it's clearly not true. So there isn't this engraving up there, you know, in God engraving in the book and fixing us, our future is all written down, and you know, the secretary up there, we're given the chotemet, like gemar chatima tova, boom, pakid, next. So it isn't engraved, and it isn't determined, and it isn't frozen, but it's also not chaos, and not ultimate, just free randomness. Arbitrary, totally arbitrary, because then there's no such thing as human responsibility, and no morality would work, and everything is chaos, everything is just lost. So in between the two is the middle way, and that means freedom, and yet there are patterns. So the Stephen that's made every minute is a form that is fixed and seems to be a pattern, but there's freedom there to be different kinds of Stephen and to be different kinds of person, and more freedom than one realizes usually. And the more you practice, the more you find that you become freer within the limits of the pattern called Stephen or Leela. There are certain limits. I can't turn into Leela. Don't know whether you want that. We'll swap over. But there are limits. But the more you practice, the more you find that this kind of formula between chaos and fixation or determinism, we find ourselves more and more free. That there is a dynamic there where freedom is opening to us the more we are practice spiritually, the more wisdom we have. And the freedom goes also with a certain with uncertainty. We can't have the one without the other. The uncertainty is part of things. And here we get to a difficult place where religious people have broken their heads on this for centuries and thousands of years. Tzadik varalo. That's the difficulty. Difficulty is there's freedom, but this freedom also goes with uncertainty. We cannot predict. There is nothing linear in this process. And if you want to look at it in the form of systems theory, which is a kind of Western view of karma, Torah, Marachot, the butterfly effect, if you like, that the butterfly in the Amazon makes a tsunami in the Pacific Ocean because of the interconnection of everything. So that's why we can't predict things. They're just too vast and too complex, and we cannot predict. And it's obvious that we cannot predict, and it's a much... I mean, if we think of 6 million people going into dying in the Shoah, being killed in the Shoah, the good, the not good, the meditators, the non-meditators, the ones, the thieves, and the tzaddikim, all went. So instead of saying, "Oh, there is no God, there is no spirituality," it's we can also be more wise than that and say, "Yes, there is pattern. But there is uncertainty. There's no guarantees in this business. It's too big for us to have any guarantee. We may be the most fantastic meditators, the most perfect Buddha, and we get knocked over by a bus. What to do?" So, a little story, just to emphasize this point. Story from the suttas. One day the Buddha was in a village and he met a Jain. A Jain is an Indian sect who are practicing a lot of austerity, sagfanut, yogis. And he met a Jain that had been standing on one leg for 10 years. And he said to this Jain, what are you doing? And he said, "I'm standing on one leg for years." He said, "Why are you doing this?" "I want to burn up my karma and become enlightened." And the Buddha said to him, "Okay, how much karma have you burnt up in 10 years?" And he said, I can't tell you. How much longer do you have to go? I can't tell you. I don't know. How will you know when the job is done and you've burnt up your karma and you've become a saint, enlightened? How will you know when the job is done? He said, I don't know. So the Buddha said, as the Buddha does, well, maybe you better do something else. exactly for that, from this point of view, that you can't measure it. It's not something that you can have any guarantees. It's not a linear process. The thing is far too big. So, a couple of conclusions from this understanding of karma I want to offer to you that are more in the realm of an understanding, and then we're going to go and look into how that affects our practice. The first understanding, I think, is very important to us, that the attitude of karma, or the understanding of karma, means that we are constantly sowing seeds. There is no meaningless action. Even a thought is meaningful. And the reason is that everything karma, the law of karma, is that the sowing of the seeds. The seeds that we sow bear fruit. That things happen because of what happened before. Meaning that everything you do goes into the world and makes waves. And it makes meaningful results. So things aren't lost totally. Okay, they may not seem very important because of the thing is so big, but it is an important attitude and understanding. For example, we used to do, and there's still some of us here also in this room who were very occupied in doing peace work with Israelis, Palestinians, and others to try and help the conflict. And we're doing work, we have done work, and there's still work going on in the Dharma way. And the question always comes up, well, how much peace did you make? What did you do? And sometimes, you know, officials or politicians say, how much peace, just like the Buddha asked the Jain, how much peace did you make in the Middle East from the peace walks you're doing, or from the dialogue work you're doing, or from the groups that you're doing? How much peace did you make in the Middle East? And it's an illegitimate question. It's not measurable in that way. But the understanding of karma means that you're sowing seeds, and the world will take those seeds and do what it wants. And that takes the pressure off you when you're trying to help others. It takes the pressure off you to keep measuring results, because you really can't know, but you do know that something changed because of what you did, and you offer that to the world, and the world will do what it wants in the right time, in the right moment. One thought can make radical change in the whole of the planet, of one person. I don't know what, Mahatma Gandhi. One person at the right moment, in the right time, with the right action, Mahatma Gandhi's salt march to the sea shook the British Empire and made India free. So small actions can make big results or not. It's not entirely in our hands. Therefore, it helps us, the one aspect of the law of karma helps us both to see things are meaningful and to relax around the need to measure outcomes. And for our own inner life, it just makes what we're doing meaningful. Sitting quietly, meditating for 45 minutes, it's not lost, that thing that we did, instead of watching TV at home, for example. It's not lost. It made a wave. A wave, of course, because karma is so big, every wave includes us and others. There is no real distinction. The waves just spread. They have no real address. They just go everywhere. So sitting quietly 45 minutes is a meaningful act that makes waves and results for us and for the world. It's not lost. The Buddha said so. Every piece of practice that we did is somewhere in us and the world. In other words, when we fill the bucket with mindfulness, there's no hole at the bottom that it all drains away again. When we may think it, we go out to the world and we think, oh, back to Tel Aviv, oh my God, it's the same old story. It's actually not so. There's something has changed. We may want more, like the jain, we want to measure, but something has changed, some meaningful acts. So karma gives us a sense that things are meaningful. The second understanding from karma is also very important, that if we, you know, it's crucially important, actually, I would say, that if we understand that things are being made according to the model of that they were, there's something in that that's very dynamic. Like, things are rolling along. We make ourselves as we go along. Things make themselves as they go along. The whole thing is movable. We're playing a game of football, and the goalposts constantly move. We need to go there, and then we're there, then we're there. So everything is dynamic, much more dynamic than we realize. Because we have a tendency to struggle with things that look very fixed. Like, we have anger. And anger seems to be with us all the time. And every day we react with anger to frustration, to school, something happens and we react with anger, and again something, and I'm such a problem, I have a problem of anger, and it stays with me, and I have an anger problem. But actually, if we look, things are much more dynamic than that. And the anger comes and goes when it needs to, because of situations, because of karma, and it goes. Then it may come back because of patterns. But if we look carefully, things, and we ourselves, are much more dynamic than we thought before. Much more flexible and dynamic. We're not frozen, again, like the Buddha said. It's not a frozen situation that we're stuck with our personality and fixed. And a third point is this business of, we're not in control, and yet we do have control. Somehow or other, that we're not in control, that the picture is so big, that the patterns are formed and they form us, takes down the tendency that we blame ourselves for our own suffering. We tend to blame ourselves. We feel a victim. We feel it's my fault that I did this, it's my fault that I'm angry, it's my fault that I have a critical mind. Then that adds to the critical mind, the judgment that I make on myself, I didn't do it, I'm no good, I succeed or don't succeed, I must succeed, I'm a failure. Or we tend to blame ourselves, the self gets into these loops. But if we take a big picture and we see we are part of the network of karma, that is waves coming and going, and waves just came on us and made us. They're not ours. We didn't make ourselves. We are being made all the time by all the kind of influences and patterns, including our own, that we sow for ourselves. But the whole world is making us all the time. So it takes away the tendency and the need to blame ourselves for what it is, who we are. We can just feel we're formed by the big picture. of karma, which is constructing and reconstructing us all the time. So let's focus a little bit on the practice. How do we change our fate or change our experience? How do we do this in the Buddhist way or in the Buddha Dharma? And I think the first thing, it's obvious, is as much the seeds we sow are pure, so our karma, our experience, will be pure. As much as the seeds that we sow are pure, so is the fruit. And the Dhammapada, in one of the most well-known quotations that is so widely known as in the world as a Buddhist quotation, is from the Dhammapada, that says pure, with a pure mind, happiness will follow like a cart, a horse, a cart following a horse. With an impure mind, unhappiness can follow like a cart following a horse. That the pure mind tends to bring happiness, and the impure mind tends to make us miserable. Tends to. Again, no rules, no linear, there's no weak measure, may not happen, but tends to. And so I'll talk about what this means, pure, in a minute. But right now I want to focus on one word there, which is mind. That the operation of our practice is really about mind. We may experience body, our body hurts, but actually it's the mind that hurts. And mind is where we purify, and mind is where karma is changed for us. Mind being intention, how we are in the world. How we are in the world. And there's a very famous example of this, how there's a person putting a knife in another person. If it's someone stabbing, wanting to kill another person, then the intention there is damaging, hurtful, and liable to produce damaging waves for the person who did it, for the other person, and everywhere else. But if it's a surgeon, menateach, doing the same action, putting a knife into flesh, the intention is utterly different, of healing, and the karma is utterly different. Same action, intention is 180 degrees different. So it's the mind that sows seeds. The actions follow the mind. And there's quite a nice quotation that goes like this, and I'll say it in English and then in Hebrew. Sow a thought and you reap a word. Sow a word and you reap a action. Sow an action and you reap a habit. Sow a habit and you reap a personality. Sow a personality and you reap a fate, goral. So, zorim machshava kotsrim mila. Zorim mila kotsrim pula. Zorim pula kotsrim hergel. Zorim hergel kotsrim ishiut. Zorim ishiut ve kotsrim goral. The Theravada, a nice Theravada poem. But it gives a sense that mind is where it's all happening. That starts with a thought. Starts with small things. What is my thinking? From there, the waves go out in the world of our actions, based on our thoughts, our understanding, our wisdom, our intentions, hitkavnuyot, etc., etc. Then we make action based on our understanding and our intention. And all of this is only in the present moment. We don't have control of the future. We sow seeds in the present. They say, take care of the present, the future takes care of itself. We can only do things in the present. A mind is going to the future, but actually we're only living in the present. So it's the present where the seeds are sown. So how do we purify our minds and therefore change the seeds we sow, the habits, the goral, the experiences and the karma? And of course, besides the whole area of morality and sila and values, which are crucial, and we talked about that at the beginning of the retreat, we also purify our mind in several ways, which we're doing right here. The first way, that we don't take it as being very important, but it is just our ability to sit quiet. The fact that we can sit quiet and be with our breath and body as much as we can, not harming anyone, not busy, not sowing seeds of busyness, of isheket, of running, of hurting others and ourselves, of confusions, and it's just we stopped. That itself is already part of purifying the mind. It's a sort of touch of the purity already. It's where our Buddha mind is right here. Just simple being. And we talked about it at the beginning, we keep talking about it. It's fine just to sit quiet and be with our being. And that's learning or relearning or allowing the Buddha mind, the free mind, the being in us to be expressed. And there's something pure in that being. Even if we think, oh, so many thoughts and they're giving me such a hard time, and I, you know, it's just, I'm not doing this. This whole operation is crazy. It's not working for me. I have two breaths and then 10 minutes of fantasies about the future. It's actually not. Don't reduce the importance of something very pure and clean, which is sitting quietly, being with ourselves, and not running away, not covering it over, as I say, not in speedily rushing around the world doing damage and helping climate change. So that space, we can call it space, giving ourselves space is part of being pure. The more space we give ourselves, there's something there which is pure in us that is expressed. Very simple. Samadhi, I mentioned sila, samadhi, panya. This is samadhi. Samadhi, we just collect ourselves quietly in one place, silent, steady, and pure. Something pure emerges. The other aspect, though, more towards vipassana, is purification, where we're not just touching the pure in us, but we are working with material that comes up. So it's purification rather than purity. Tahor is tihur. We work with. That's another aspect of purifying the mind. And here we use the attention that we're building, and so far in this retreat we've been building our power to see, to be mindful, to see our inner world and our outer world also. And our power to see, we begin to look at ourselves in the mirror. And when we look at ourselves in the mirror, we see all the stuff. We actually see all the karma. We see who we are. We see the thoughts we have. We see the pains in the body. We see the pains in the heart. We see the sadness and the joys. We see the frustrations and the memories. We see the escapes that we have. We see our addictions and our patterns, tavniot, and we see our freedom and the joys. So we're looking in the mirror, we see all of that. And the power of Vipassana, which perhaps we're beginning to do here now, and Leela expressed it this morning in terms of pain, body pain, how to work with body pain. The power of Vipassana is seeing ourselves in the mirror and letting the stuff go. And we let the stuff go exactly because karma is dynamic. It is not stuck. It is actually not ours. It's a difficult, maybe difficult for you to grasp that. But the anger that arises actually doesn't belong to us. It's more of a kind of kartsiya that's sitting somewhere. But it's not really us. Because if we look carefully at our experience, we see that everything comes and goes by itself. So we actually don't have to work like crazy getting rid of things that hurt us. We have to realize that things go by themselves. They come and go when they want. They come and they go because the whole of karma is completely dynamic. This anger, this angry thought is there, but the next minute it's gone, and instead there's the bell for lunch. Where's the anger gone? The minute before, I'm angry and I'm full of frustration and irritation and annoyance and my back is hurting and so on. The bell goes and no hurting back, no irritation, no anger, no thoughts about I want to escape. How did that happen? It's because it's not ours in the first place. Karma is dynamic. We are dynamic. Everything comes and goes. So we don't need to fight against the things that we see about ourselves. We just need to notice how they come and they go anyway. Everything is dynamic. One of the key, I would say, perhaps one of the most beautiful understandings of the Buddha Dharma is how much we don't need to work to get rid of stuff, and how much we don't need to repaint everything pink either. We don't need to repaint pouring bosem into the chara. We don't need to repaint the world pink. It's not necessary. We don't need to sit there thinking, oh, 10 years I've been working on positive thinking, like the Americans tell me I have to do. Because we just see that everything passes by itself, in its nature. It is dynamic. Things go by themselves. We just have to really see that. And that's the power of Vipassana, of purification, to really notice the way everything is dynamic and passing. And we'll be working on that more during this retreat. So all of the purity and the purification changes our fate, because we sow different seeds, and the different seeds have different fruit, both for us and for others. And as Leela mentioned yesterday, also in the Jewish tradition, there is understanding. We were talking about it yesterday, Leela and I, and Leela said there's an understanding that fate or karma or goral doesn't work in the same way if you do tshuva, because you become a different person. So fate, goral or karma can't relate. Doesn't relate anymore in the same way to the new person. You are different. So fate doesn't work like that anymore as it did before. The mechanism of habit forming creation is different. The whole track of creation goes somewhere else because we are different. And so I just want to finish with something that's really going to confuse you completely. Or not. But it's not something that you can really hold with a rational mind at all, but I just want to offer it to you as something for contemplation. In a certain way, in an ultimate way, when we're talking about awakening, we're talking about the Elohut, the world of, I would say, the divine world, which you could say is the world of nirvana or awakening. In the Buddhist language, karma vanishes completely. It just doesn't exist. In other words, karma is, to some extent, a point of view of beings struggling with their life. And when from the awakened place karma vanishes, there is just existence, with no karma doing things to people or to ants or to birds, because it's just one great interbeing which is there. And you can think about it in one way, maybe helpful. There, for karma to actually work on us, we need to be a subject. If we're not a subject, then karma has nowhere to work. If we're a universal subject, universal, cosmic, if we're the cosmos, nowhere for karma to work. If we suffer, there has to be a sufferer to suffer. Without a sufferer, there is no suffering. Where is suffering? It's gone. Needs a subject to suffer. So, in a certain place, karma goes when there is a big view of things. And we can participate in that a little bit. The karma becomes less pressure on us as we expand our view. We feel more free within fate as whatever it brings us. So thank you. We'll take a couple of minutes of quiet.